It's a little hard to proceed after what I've just had the, it's hard to describe it as pleasure of listening to, but the beautiful words from both of these wonderful women. I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation. I'd like to say that it's a privilege for me to appear with Nurit and with Miriam. I think tonight reinforces something that I feel so strongly, and I think is something that we, whether we're in Canada or in the U.S. or in other countries, it's something that we can do about it, and that is to make sure that the voices of Palestinians and that the voices of Israelis who have these important messages to bring to us, that those are heard. One of the things that I have learned in my 3 years since Rachel was killed in my own country is that Palestinians existed in my community. I was not close to this issue before my daughter brought me to it. And there were Palestinians in our midst, and I didn't know they were there. And as I've traveled, I've heard stories from the Palestinian people, some who were telling those stories for some of the first times, because through their years being here, it was sometimes very difficult to tell those stories in my country. And I've heard from young people about grandparents who changed their names when they came to the U.S. in order to disguise the fact that they were Palestinian. And I also learned that among some people, I think, in my country, and I think I may have been one of these people, there was a view that there was a monolithic Jewish opinion on this issue, or that there was a monolithic Israeli opinion on this issue. And I think I have learned, and it's been one of the things that's made it most possible for me to do the work that I do, that there is a wide range of opinion among those people, in the same way that there is in my own country about issues like the war in Iraq and other issues. Nurit and I think, both reflect the senseless loss and pain that people have suffered and continue to suffer from for now over 40 years, almost 40 years of this occupation, this Israeli occupation. But we reflect just one tiny, tiny fraction of that suffering. Miriam told a bit of her story tonight. It's the first that I heard that. And as I said, I know now that every Palestinian whom I meet has a story that is marked with loss and pain. And there is a breadth of suffering for the Palestinians that makes their loss different from mine. I lost my daughter, but I live in a place where I have a great deal of privilege, and where, because she recognized the privilege that she had, she made the decision to go to Palestine. And Palestinians lose loved ones in numbers that greatly surpass the losses of Israelis and others. But they also experience the omnipresence of occupation in all of its manifestations. At a conference that was hosted by the Rachel Corrie Foundation for Peace and Justice this spring in our hometown of Olympia, Washington, I learned that Amira Haas, who is the Israeli author and journalist, talks of the irrevocable loss of time that Palestinians experience because of the occupation. We hear frequently, I think, about loss of Palestinian homes and olive orchards, of lives sometimes, but seldom about the loss of time and how once that time is taken away from people, it can never be returned to them. Palestinians wait and they lose time at the checkpoints, as Miriam told you about. And as they try to go to school and to work or to travel for medical care, they lose time. Palestinians wait for permits that never come to build houses or to travel from Ramallah to Jerusalem. They wait for the day when they might travel between the West Bank and Gaza to see relatives that they haven't seen in years. When I attended a conference in Bethlehem, a nonviolence, international conference on nonviolence in December, I was communicating with friends in Gaza saying that we were going to be in the area and we wanted to come, and I explained why. And they said, "Can we come to the conference on nonviolence?" And I thought, that is a very good question. And I posed it to Mubarak Awad with Nonviolence International in the U.S., who was himself deported from Israel for his nonviolent work during the First Intifada. And he found a way that three Palestinians from Gaza were able to come to that conference, and it was quite remarkable. One was a young woman who had never before been out of Gaza. And it's an indication of the challenge that exists in people just being able to move in that really very small area. Palestinians wait for the world to finally see and do something, to demand justice so that there can, in fact, be a chance for peace. Palestinians wait and wait and wait as more and more irretrievable time is lost to them. My daughter Rachel grew up in Olympia, Washington. She loved Seattle, the mountains, the forest, and the sea. She was a writer, and as a college student, she wrote about where we live. She said, "Studying the history of this area roots me. It makes me more conscious of the land and more conscious of myself and of the people around me as actors in history. Studying local history is motivating. We've certainly waded in the same water and wandered on the same beaches as very brave people. It makes bravery seem more possible, something that can occur on the forest roads around the Skokomish." Rachel's response to 9/11 was to become very involved in the peace movement in Olympia. And she was drawn to this issue of Palestine and Israel by people who live in Olympia. One who is an Israeli woman who lives there now, whose family members survived the Holocaust, who grew up and lived in Israel for 29 years and has become a powerful voice against the occupation. And Rachel was impacted by activists who had spent years in the West Bank and came back to the U.S. and, after seeing what they had seen, continue, as so many people do, the work on this issue. And Rachel was impacted by local ISM, International Solidarity Movement volunteers, who in the summer of 2002 traveled to the West Bank and Gaza to join Palestinians in nonviolent direct action resistance to the occupation. She learned from all of these people. She started studying Arabic. She expanded her own study of this. And she wrote in her journal, "Why do I want to go? I've been organizing in Olympia for a little over a year on anti-war global justice issues. And at some point, it started to feel like this work is missing a solid connection to the people who are most immediately impacted by U.S. foreign policy. I feel pretty isolated from the world in some ways because of living in Olympia my whole life. So I've had this underlying need to go to a place and meet people who are on the other end of the portion of my tax money that goes to fund the U.S. and other militaries." On March 16, 2003, Rachel was brutally crushed by an Israeli Defense Forces Caterpillar D9R bulldozer as she stood between that bulldozer and a Palestinian home that was threatened with demolition. Members of the family who owned the home, two brothers, a pharmacist and an accountant, their wives and their five young children watched through a crack in their garden wall as the bulldozer approached. Since September 2000, over 1,700 homes in Rafah were threatened and eventually demolished as Israeli occupation forces cleared a wide buffer strip and constructed a large steel wall along Rafah's border with Egypt. More than 10% of the population of Rafah lost their homes. Most of these people were refugees, many dispossessed for a second or third time. Human Rights Watch, wrote in a report in 2004 called Raising Rafah, Mass Home Demolitions in the Gaza Strip, that the pattern of destruction strongly suggests that Israeli forces demolished homes wholesale, regardless of whether they posed a specific threat in violation of international law. In most of the cases, Human Rights Watch found the destruction was carried out in the absence of military necessity. The Israeli Committee Against Housing Demolitions points out that 60% of the home demolitions that occurred are clearing demolitions. And I always like to emphasize this. I don't know what happens in the Canadian press, but I can tell you that in the American media, whenever there is mention of a home demolition, there's always a tagline, the same sentence that appears in AP articles and so forth, that states that home demolitions are, I think they say, a 10-year-old policy of the Israeli government to destroy the homes of suicide bombers or of those who commit violence against Israel. And that's the end of the explanation. And I just want to reiterate that the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions tells us that 60% of the demolitions that occurred, and these are clearing demolitions, and these are the demolitions that were done in Gaza where Rachel was. 30% of demolitions are because people in the Jerusalem area, Palestinians, do not have permits to build homes, many times on their own property, most times on their own property. And for those of us that are not familiar with this system, there is really a dual set of laws that works to keep the population of Palestinians down in the Jerusalem area. And so 30% of the demolitions are directed against these Palestinians without permits. 10% of the demolitions are punitive demolitions. So they are done to families who may have had a suicide bomber in their family or someone else who may have threatened violence towards Israel. But I want to remind you that under international law, and according to the U.S., according to U.S. Law as well, or our State Department's views on this, these are illegal. Even though they're, and I always ask people, how would you feel if a member of your family committed a crime and then a government came in and destroyed the home of your entire family? That's not something that we in civilized society do. Though the demolitions after disengagement ceased in Gaza, sadly, they do continue in East Jerusalem and the West Bank as Israeli occupation forces continue the land grab and continue to build an apartheid wall that absorbs more Palestinian land, expands illegal settlements around Jerusalem, and bulldozes these homes with Caterpillar equipment. As Rabbi Michael Lerner said in Tikkun magazine in March and April of this past year, inch by inch, dunam by dunam, the steady erosion of Palestinian homes and agricultural land continues. The Palestinians see it happening each day. We ignore it and focus on the public relations statements of the various political leaders and thus don't understand why even now there is so much ongoing anger in Palestine. In the work that Rachel did, she worked with Israeli peace activists as she tried to understand the destruction of the Palestinian water supply. She received guidance from a reservist in the Israeli military, a father of two teenage sons who taught her Hebrew phrases to shout through her megaphone when she encountered bulldozers and tank operators. She was held as she died by Alice, who is a Jewish member of ISM from the UK, one of the 20-30% of ISM members who are members of the Jewish faith. Alice told me, after Rachel was killed, that she has cousins in Israel that she fears for whenever she hears of a suicide bombing. Rachel, I believe, joined the growing number of Jewish Americans, Jews all around the world, and Israelis who expressed to us that as they work to end the occupation and the violence that it has perpetuated, that they are working to save the soul of Israel. I don't want to take too long here. I'm sure you're all warm, but I do want to say that I, this week, read an article It was published in the Arabian Business magazine, a publication, in which Michael Tarazzi makes some significant points that I would just like to share. Michael Tarazzi is a Harvard-educated Palestinian-American lawyer, a scholar, and a former legal advisor to the Palestinian National Authority. He stated that the situation today is ominous. The Israeli government under Olmert is on track, as we've heard tonight, to unilaterally set Israel's borders, taking much of the West Bank through large illegal settlements and also the Jordan Valley. And right now, Hamas, in charge of the Palestinian government, and President Abu Mazen now battle in a conflict that serves the Israeli government's plans.